This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, a rare bit of good news to report and the perfect antidote to the Donald Trump blues. Farm workers in Washington State win union recognition after a three-year-long battle. We'll be joined for a discussion with Maru Mora Villalpando, communications coordinator for their organization, Familias Unidas por la Justicia.
And you're good at that headline. I'm glad you got that headline. Also, we take a look at the lives of John Boehner and Paul Ryan, which seem to be going in opposite directions after one replaced the other to lead the U.S. House of Representatives last year. That story later.
I know who I'd prefer to be. John Boehner.
Yeah.
And chain drinking wine and smoking cigarettes.
Especially after I tell you how he's cashing out later.
Oh, wow. Oh, more wine and cigarettes to come. And President Obama is still selling the TPP as the most progressive trade deal ever. And now helping him in this endeavor to sell the most progressive trade deal ever, billionaire racist authoritarian and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. We'll be talking about that later.
Yeah, and I hear he's not the only one. But first, Donald Trump, his years-long personal crusade to determine whether or not President Obama was actually born in the U.S. has finally ended. In fact, he largely wasted his time. There's more than enough evidence to prove that Mr. Obama was indeed born in the U.S., born in Hawaii. But we all know why Trump really launched the effort. It was a dog whistle to racists. And whether or not Trump knew he'd run for president at the time he began his birther psychobabble, it certainly helped him activate a base within the Republican Party that has, since, propelled him to a position that is perilously close to actually winning the White House. Only now, all that birther nonsense has shifted from being advantageous for Trump to now being a huge liability. He's already got the birther electorate on his side. What he needs now is to get votes from everybody else if he wants to win the election, assuming, and this is always a qualifier when discussing Trump, assuming he does actually want to win the election and that this whole thing isn't just a game to boost his brand or to launch some sort of Trump media enterprise. Wouldn't be surprised at any of that either. So last Friday, Trump convened this big press conference at his fancy schmancy hotel here in D.C. He had all the press turned in because he teased that he would make a big announcement, likely about the birther stuff. So all the cable news channels were covering it when Trump said this.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it. You know what I mean. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now we all want to get back to it. Funny, a few years ago when we were all trying to talk about the important issues facing the country, the recession and all that stuff, Trump wanted to talk about the birther stuff. But now he wants to get to the important issues. So with that, Trump tried to put the birther thing, his baby, the issue that has catapulted him to the top within the most retrograde of the two parties in the U.S., he's put that baby to rest for good, he hopes. By the way, that stuff about Clinton starting the birther stuff, that's not exactly true. It is worth mentioning, though, that her campaign was alleged to have spread around that photo during the 2008 primary of Barack Obama in Somali garb to, you know, raise questions about his background. Conservative website published the photo and reported that they were given the photo by someone affiliated with Clinton's campaign who told the outlet, quote, "Wouldn't we be seeing this photo on the cover of every magazine if it were Clinton?" The Clinton campaign denied they had anything to do with this, as they would deny it. But there was enough evidence for the Obama campaign in 2008 to accuse Clinton of playing dirty tricks with the photo. So this isn't just conspiracy theories that the Clinton campaign spread around this photo of Obama in 2008. President Obama himself believed it in 2008. So the questions about Obama's background did emerge in 2008 during the primary, likely as a result of the Clinton campaign, but the full-fledged birther stuff didn't kick off until later, after he was elected, when people like Orly Tates came out of the woodwork. Anyway, Trump can close the book on the movement now, though probably he might get asked a few times about it in the coming days. He might get asked about it during the debate. But the press, particularly the television press, has proven itself unable to hold Trump accountable on his numerous scandals, and really that may not entirely be their fault. I was thinking about this the other day, every few days it seems like, at least every other day, a new thing about Trump comes out. Now, I know the Clinton campaign and their surrogates want us to believe that she's the only person that the press is covering critically, that the only thing that the news media is focused on is the Clinton Foundation and her emails. But really, there's a news story about Donald Trump every other day. Trump illegally soliciting donations from foreign lawmakers. Trump enriching himself through his campaign contributions. Trump using campaign cash to buy copies of his own book. Trump licensing deals around the world that call into question how he'd manage foreign policy as president. These stories are always coming out. Trump bilking thousands of American small businesses out of payments. Trump's ties to Russia and the former Ukrainian ruling party. Trump's wife's immigration status. Trump's insane doctor. Again, these stories come out all the time. Trump's alleged racist rental practices. Trump's comments about Mexicans. Trump's comments about Muslims. Trump claiming Obama founded ISIS. Trump claiming the Second Amendment can save us from the Clinton presidency. I could go on, but it's almost as though there's too much to process here. Literally, there's something new out there every other day, and people just can't focus on any one of them. It just creates this haze that surrounds Trump that people know is overwhelmingly negative and bad, but they have trouble articulating which singular thing they're particularly enraged about. On the other side, with Clinton, there's her foundation and her emails, stuff that's a lot easier to focus on because it's not an endless stream of new scandals. It's all related to the same thing that people can drill down on. And this is almost unfair to Clinton. I mean, it's not the media treatment that's unfair. As I said, Trump is the subject of negative press attention every day. These stories come out. It's just the way things seem to be working out. I don't think it's a deliberate strategy by the Trump campaign to squash one scandal with another over and over and over again until people just become desensitized to it all or hypnotized by it all. But that's what seems to be happening, and it appears to be benefiting him. I mean, how many politicians collapse in the polls as a result of one scandal or one gaffe? Trump does it every other day, and he's making up ground against Clinton. So Trump is hoping his statements last Friday put the birther issue to bed. And frankly, the best way to do that is by starting a brand new ridiculous crusade or saying something else that's completely controversial or racist. Like Trump's going to announce this week that the U.S. never went to the moon and that Buzz Aldrin is a liar. That'll get people talking about the birther stuff at least. And to be honest, the fact that the birther stuff is back in the news, it doesn't really help Clinton all that much either. The average voter is likely just turned off by the birther coverage. Like, what the hell are we even talking about this for still? That's assuming they're even paying attention to the coverage. And those who are just barely paying attention to the political coverage right now, which are most people, now what they have is a soundbite that the news media will play over and over again of Trump basically disavowing the birthers, which is what he wants. The only people really whipped up into a frenzy by Trump's birther comments, both those supporting it and both people who are offended by it, are people who've already made their choice on who they're going to vote for this election. So this is yet another day in which the Clinton campaign isn't out there proposing progressive policies and trying to stabilize her hemorrhaging support, which is fleeing to third parties, including, shockingly, far right-wing third parties. Sorry, I had to take a sip of water. As Clinton knows, it's tough for me sometimes to remember to drink water, too. I'll admit that. When her campaign came out and said, Clinton doesn't like drinking water, that's one of the few times I've actually sympathized with her and felt, you know, for her, because I too do not drink enough water and would like people to constantly remind me to drink more water.
I've got
to
say, Sorry for making this connection, but you are from Marco Rubio's home state.
That's true. I am a Floridian. Maybe it has something to do with Floridians.
Gotta drink water at inopportune times.
Yeah, and if our listeners can't see, but you know, I'm ranting into the microphone here, and I immediately dove to my right like Rubio did during his State of the Union response to grab water and drink it quickly, so people didn't notice I was actually drinking water. But
your problem is your energy is too low. You need to drink more coffee.
Yeah, I've never gotten into that stuff. You drink enough coffee for the both of us. So back to what I'm getting at here about Clinton's support dissipating and going actually to right-wing third parties. A Quinnipiac National poll released last week showed that Clinton leads Trump among voters aged 18 to 34 by 21 points. That's a 55-34% margin. She leads nationally in a head-to-head poll because of that, large part because of that lead among 18 to 34-year-olds. She leads nationally by 5 points. And of course, that belies what people like Claire Jeffrey, who we threw in the garbage can last week, by the way, it belies what they claim, which is that millennials should be blamed for a Clinton loss. Actually, no, they're the ones carrying Clinton. It's the old people who are most likely to support Trump. So blame your own damn generation, Clara. The thing about millennials, though, is that over the last month, likely in response to the Clinton campaign strategy to appeal to establishment Republicans and national security hawks, millennials are increasingly looking at alternatives in November. When Quinnipiac threw the third-party candidates into the mix, her support among millennials goes off the cliff. As Jim Newell over at Slate points out, in the four-way poll, Clinton's overall lead over Trump drops to 2 percentage points nationally, and her support among 18 to 34-year-olds collapses by 24 percentage points, down to 31%. Again, when it's just Clinton versus Trump, she leads 55-34% among 18 to 34-year-olds. But her 55% support drops down to 31% when third parties are considered. Meanwhile, Trump's support among the millennial generation falls by a more modest 8 percentage points, down to 26%. This race becomes a lot closer with the third parties involved, which they are involved. And where's all that support going? Well, mostly Libertarian Gary Johnson. He's earning 29% of the 18 to 34-year-old crowd. That's more than Donald Trump. And the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, is nabbing 15% of the 18 to 34% crowd. That's not too shabby. So essentially, at this point in the race, Hillary Clinton, more so than Donald Trump, is losing voters to the freaking Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, the radical small government corporate rule candidate. Yeah, he's good on some foreign policy stuff. He's good at railing against surveillance. He likes to get high and thinks everybody else should be allowed to get high too. Though he reportedly has not burned since his campaign started last year.
Sell out.
Johnson's also pretty good on immigration too, I'll admit. But make no mistake about it, when it comes to economic policies, Gary Johnson is crazier than the far-right Freedom Caucus in Congress. As Newell notes in his Slate piece, under Johnson, rich people would be richer, poor people would be poorer, and sick people would be sicker. Our only hope would be that the country would get too baked to notice. Well, we're working on it over here, buddy.
Indeed we are. But it is important here. I mean, we got to talk about the Gary Johnson effect a little more. He is definitely taking from Clinton, maybe even more than Stein. I mean, just to reiterate, the drop in support for Clinton when pollsters mention Johnson and Stein is more than just the support for Stein herself.
Yeah.
And the drop in support for Trump is way less than the support in the rise in support for Johnson when you enter the fray, when the third and fourth parties enter the fray.
So what does that all mean?
It really goes to show how awful a candidate Hillary is and how seriously younger voters see her as dangerous on the world stage, too. I mean, Newell was talking a lot about, Johnson being, someone that younger people would like for his foreign policy, despite the fact that he doesn't know what Aleppo is, because Hillary's so hawkish and because you see her working to rehabilitate these awful neocons who, by the way, were barely even relevant in the Republican primary.
Yeah, they weren't relevant at all. And The question is here, with less than 2 months, I guess, to go till the election, fewer than 2 months to go until the election, will Clinton learn these lessons, learn that her approach is turning off these millennial voters, and change? And so far, it doesn't seem like her surrogates at least have gotten the message, because as the polls tighten up, we see supporters blaming not Clinton campaign officials, not the strategy that's been put forward, but instead blaming Bernie Sanders. Kevin Drum over at Mother Jones.
Drum me, daddy.
Writes, don't hate millennials, save it for Bernie Sanders. And he says that Bernie Sanders' negative attacks against Clinton has primed millennials to hate her during the general election, even though the main issue that's been hampering Clinton during the general election has been her emails in the Clinton Foundation. And I distinctly remember Bernie Sanders not attacking her about her emails and saying that the people are damn tired about hearing the emails.
I also distinctly remember Hillary losing the millennial vote in 2008. This isn't new.
Yes, and she was losing the millennial vote to Bernie Sanders big time as well. So she's always had troubles with millennials. It's not just because of Bernie Sanders. It's time for Clinton surrogates and the campaign to look at themselves in the mirror and look for changes.
It is, seriously, stop it's Trump really from, dangerous. It's really
stop from Trump winning. We're begging you, please. More unanimous dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you, still broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
Rarely when covering labor issues and matters concerning justice for marginalized communities does one have good news to report. But today we have just that. In Washington State in 2013, farm workers, primarily migrants from Mexico, decided they were sick of being given poor living conditions and fed up with being insulted by managers while conducting tough work for little pay. So they started to organize a union and called on consumers to boycott the corporate customers of their farm, Driscoll Berries and Haagen-Dazs ice cream. I've had my share of Haagen-Dazs in my time. Full disclosure, I'll just say that. In the past. Anyway, the company Sakuma Berries responded by trying to bust the effort, as bosses tend to do. That's according to The Stranger, an alt weekly based in Seattle, which has reporting on the organizational effort since it launched. As the campaign got underway, the farm reacted by firing charismatic and outspoken workers, The Stranger reported, shipping in and out seasonal guest workers shipped from Mexico, and stationing security guards around the farm provided labor camps where workers lived. There is nothing to negotiate, said a farm spokesperson in 2013. He said the union campaign was being driven by outside agitators. The farm angrily accused us, The Stranger, of reporting fictions. But the workers did not give up, maintaining their calls on shoppers throughout the West Coast to boycott Driscoll's and Haagen-Dazs. And fast forward a few years later, with the farm under new management, they have won, partially, they've won union recognition. On Monday, the employees of Sakuma Brothers Berry Farm voted 195 to 58 to unite as a collective bargaining unit under the banner of Familias Unidas por la Justicia, the group they founded in 2013. FUJ will now represent over 500 Triqui, Mixteco, and Spanish-speaking workers at the farm in negotiations for a union contract. And the group has called on the boycott of Driscoll's and Haagen-Dazs to come to an end. FUJ is only the second independent farm worker union to form in Washington State in the last 3 decades, according to the group, and the first to be led by indigenous workers. Joining us now to talk more about this issue is FUJ communications coordinator Maru Mora Villalpando. And she's joining us from Washington State. Maru, welcome, and congratulations on winning the election.
Well, thank you for the invitation. And yes, we're really happy about the results of the election.
So obviously, contract negotiations are next. What kind of deal is FUJ hoping to get, and how optimistic are you at the moment?
Well, we're very, very I think that FUJ accomplished what many couldn't believe it could be accomplished, especially because of being led by workers that speak either Mixteco or Triqui as their main language. We usually, during meetings, we have interpreters into Spanish and into English. So it's amazing meetings having different languages being spoken. I think that what FEJ expects out of these negotiations is what they've been asking for all along. First of all, to have a living wage, having also the opportunity to have a wage that they don't have to negotiate every morning. Farm workers in Washington are the only workers that go out to the fields and work without knowing exactly how much they're going to get paid every day.
And sorry, just to clarify, this is more to do than just with farm workers getting paid by what they pick every day. Is that about the rates of the weight being negotiated every morning too?
Yeah, because what workers have been asking is to have a set wage. Precisely. That is the importance of the union, being able to negotiate a contract where their wages are already set, instead of heading out to the fields and being told how much they're going to get paid per pound. That changes almost every day when you don't have a union. And when you have a union, you actually know how much you're going to earn. And there's no need for either specific negotiations or like workers did for these past 3 years, having to walk out of the field several times to pressure the company to set a better rate. So that's obviously one of the main concerns that workers have had, and one of the reasons why they started Familias in the first place. But also they're looking to have what other workers have as well. For example, access to medical care. These workers right now don't have healthcare coverage. No, they don't have access to paid sick days, for example, or holidays. And as you probably heard, farm workers are the workers that die younger than any other kind of workers. So they're looking for opportunities to have a pension plan when they can actually retire and having healthcare so they can actually continue working and being healthy and not having to die at such a young age, as it's proven already. Farm workers not only being exposed to the elements while working outdoors, but also being exposed to chemicals increase, and the way they have to pick fruits and vegetables, it really puts a lot of pressure on their bodies. This is not low skill work. This is high skill work, and it shouldn't be a work that makes you die young. And so they're looking for all these different basic rights that all workers should have to have in the contract. So all workers that come and work at Sakuma can actually benefit from those specific basic rights.
As I sort of said in the introduction, it's not often that these sorts of labor organizing campaigns can claim victories, even mere recognition, as FUJ now has won. What do you think happened between 2013 and Monday that got you to this point?
Well, first of all, it was the leadership of the farm workers. Farm workers at Sakuma have proven that they're united, that they're very well organized. Although they're migrant workers, some of them do back to California and do the migrant circle. Some workers are local, so they were able to still be together and in communication and organize off season. So that's an incredible accomplishment. On the other hand, they have support from a very specific group that is already farm worker led, community to community. Community to community is the only farm worker led organization, nonprofit organization in the state that has been doing this kind of work for many, many years. So when Familias form, they call community to community to be the support, and they have been there. We have been there in support of the workers. And then obviously having support from other unions have created a strong base of support. But most importantly, the consumers heard the call from farm workers. I think nowadays we have more socially responsible consumers that not only worry about having organic fruits and vegetables at their table, but they also worry under what labor conditions are these fruits being picked or vegetables. So I think it was a very good combination of different factors, a lot of people involved, but it was really the leadership of the indigenous workers. And I think that everybody that supported their work and followed their leadership understood what their culture is and respected their culture. And I think that's why we have now this historical moment in our hands.
Well, it actually reminds me, you just talking now about the boycott being effective reminds me of Cesar Chavez leading the grape boycott, you know, a few decades ago, and that being kind of effective in its own right. I also noticed as well that Sukuma farm workers had to walk off the job in pay negotiations as recently as July. So it definitely seems like there's a lot of dedication involved, a lot of determination in order to keep up the constant pressure on managers.
That's right. I mean, workers said it again and again. If Sukuma does well, then we are going to do well. They did not want to walk out of the fields. They didn't want to start a boycott. These are not strategies that are easy or that are cheap. For example, for workers to walk out of the fields, then they lose a day of work, right? They lose earnings. Not only that, as workers head out to the fields, they already pay for childcare. Because remember, the peak season here in Washington is during summer, and kids are off to school at that time. They also already pay for gas. You know, here in Washington State, all farm workers need to drive. Fields are huge, and they usually, if they don't live in the camps, they live in the towns nearby. Still, you need to drive long distances. So it's already an investment. You need to have paid for your lunch, right? Ahead of time, you bring your lunch with you. So it's already an investment to go out to work. And now to decide to lose a day wage, or when there were strikes more than a day, it's already a big sacrifice, but they knew they had to do it. Same with the boycott. They said, we really don't want to ask people not to buy this product. That's not what we want. But if we must, then we'll do it. That's why once Sukuma approached Familias with a draft memorandum of understanding, we were really happy. And once that was signed, Familias was more than happy to ask consumers to end the boycott.
Maru, I have to say, I haven't seen much coverage of this victory outside of local newspapers or a few independent media outlets. We cited The Stranger. This is a pretty big deal. This is the first farm worker union in Washington State led by indigenous workers. What do you make of, I guess, maybe the lack of attention nationally on it?
Yeah, we were surprised too. I think that, you know, there's usually that media, mainstream media, tends to ignore low-income people in general, and more so indigenous peoples, and more so immigrant indigenous people. Obviously, now being in the almost the end of the electoral season, with the presidential campaign almost ending, mainstream media thinks that the only issues that people care about is who they're going to vote for. When I think this was a good example, farm workers were worried to vote for their union. They voted yes for a union that is going to represent them, and it's going to be ensuring that what they want is going to happen. I think this is a good parallel to what's happening at the national level. I think a lot of people are worried about the bad and the worse options there, when we have here the example of people that work for 3 years really hard and ensured that their representation is really faithful, right? And it comes from them. So I'm really surprised that other media outlets didn't see the parallel here of having this historic election, and also the percentage of people that voted in favor, which is higher than the usual. We hear from union representatives that came to the meeting afterwards, telling us that they're used to seeing the max being a 75%. They have never seen anything above 75%. Of people voting yes for the union, and this union voted 77%, which makes it, again, in so many ways, a historical moment.
The plight of farm workers is also largely ignored in Congress here in Washington, D.C. I think the last time lawmakers even talked about the issue was back in 2009, when comedian Stephen Colbert came in and testified, and people reacted negatively because it was a comedian coming in and testifying, but he actually was able to bring more attention to the issue than anybody else has in a while, at least in Washington, D.C., in Congress. Do you think perhaps this victory can mobilize forces to take that message to Washington, D.C., and maybe push for some legislative solutions to a lot of the problems that migrant workers face?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Ramon Torres, the president of Familias Unidas, said on Tuesday, the day after the election, that he started getting more and more calls from local other farm workers in the area that want to join the union. So if only we take a look at how people reacted here locally, we know that also we're being watched by other groups in other states. And again, that's why it's so important to have these spaces where you let us tell our story and the importance of this win so we can actually mobilize at a larger scale, not only here in Skagit County or Whatcom County, but going beyond Washington State and being a union that is a national force that pushes for farm workers' rights at every level. And I mean, that's the reason why right now the union for the farm workers is so important, because there's very little protections at both state and federal level in regards to legislation for farm workers.
How have the workers been reacting to Monday's victory? Have they been enjoying it? I think I saw somewhere on the FUJ website that there was a cookout.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, all of a sudden we had a meeting plan, and we didn't know people, as they were finishing voting, they went home, they took a shower, they got into their best dresses and clothing. They got all their kids also ready to go out. And some of them actually start bringing their grills. Ooh. And others start bringing meat. So we had carne asada. And then we had a couple of, actually five cakes that said victory, Victoria in Espanol. And so we were celebrating. People brought their guitars. A lot of members of Familias Unidas are excellent musicians. So we had a lot of live music. And people were excited. People were so happy. They were also wearing their buttons that said, I voted for Familias. And right now, I think a lot of them are still thrilled when we see them. They're just smiling. They're really happy. They're still, some of them are still wearing their buttons. But a lot of them also mentioned that they're really ready to talk to the bosses and begin the negotiation process. Also, a lot of them mentioned looking forward to a best relationship with Sakuma now. They want a very productive relationship with Sakuma, which is, again, what they kept asking from day one. They didn't want to go all the way to having to do all this work. They wanted to make sure that they could have a space and sit down with the company to negotiate for a fair contract.
Well, best of luck in the negotiations. We are fresh out of time. And thank you very much for joining us today. That was FUJ Communications Coordinator Maru Mora Villalpandu. And you can follow Familias Unidas por la Logística at FUJ Washington on Twitter. Thank you, Maru.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
More unanimous dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com.
Fine website, if I may say so myself.
A fine website indeed. Speaking of fine, you know who's feeling really good today about himself, Sam?
Who's that?
One John Boehner. The former Speaker of the House last week came out of a brief retirement. Remember, he was pretty much forced out of his speakership last year by the GOP far-right flank, and he's since spent the last year mowing his lawn, drinking wine, and snarking at Ted Cruz.
Oh, there was also, sorry, I hate to interrupt you, there was also when Yoder, was it Yoder who lost his primary?
Yeah. The wine nose, Hustlecamp.
Hustlecamp, sorry, yes, Hustlecamp. Yeah, there was a, basically Boehner cheered, cheers a glass of wine to his enemy's demise on Twitter.
Yes.
So he is really not at all different from the rest of us.
Yeah, so that's been Boehner's last year. That and probably playing a lot of golf. Oh, and smoking.
Smoking. Chain smoking.
Endless smoking, tons and tons of smoking. Reportedly, when he was Speaker of the House, he smoked anywhere he wanted, even though it's against the rules to smoke within the Capitol. He did it anyways. So Boehner's been smoking a lot. And in fact, that smoking habit of his, one of the things he's best known for, has paid off in a big way, at least in the short term. In the long term, we'll see how that smoking habit pays off. Hashtag pray for Boehner. But in the short term, Boehner last week agreed to join the board of tobacco giant Reynolds America, Inc. He will now serve as a Class 2 director and serve on the board's Corporate Governance Committee, a gig that comes with a significant pay raise over what he was making in his final year as speaker last year, which was around $179,000, not too shabby. But he now will be making anywhere between twice that number and maybe as much as $1 million in compensation a year if you look at what other board members in the company make. And he could be pretty effective in helping the company, too. As NPR noted, the tobacco industry is always fighting new regulations and taxes on its products, a fight which has expanded in recent years to include e-cigarettes and cigars. Shout out to Grover Norquist, the biggest supporter of e-cigarettes out there.
Loser.
Boehner obviously still has close ties in Congress, at least among party elites, maybe not so much the right flank. Boehner has actually been doing the tobacco industry's work for quite a while, and he's been rewarded for it. Back in 1995, a long time ago, but
ooh,
the 90s.
Remember him.
The House was considering legislation that would get rid of a yearly $49 million giveaway of taxpayer money to tobacco companies. Now, during that vote on the bill, Boehner went around the House floor, and I kid you not, handed out campaign checks to lawmakers written by tobacco companies. He gave those checks to his fellow lawmakers urging a no vote, checks that were written by tobacco companies. Literally, this is what John Boehner did in 1995, walking around the House floor, handing checks to other lawmakers like he was a courier for big tobacco. A practice that I might add was completely legal. This is totally okay to do.
Still?
Yes. It's looked down upon, as far as I know. And one of the reasons why, and even Boehner at the time knew that this is, even though it's legal and he can do this, he shouldn't have been doing it. He fessed up to it, in fact.
He asked me to give out a half a dozen checks quickly before we got to the end of the month, and I complied. And I did it on the House floor, which I regret, should not have done. It's not a violation of the House rules. But it's a practice that's gone on here for a long time that we're trying to stop, and I know that I'll never do it again.
Were the checks from tobacco companies?
I think, if my memory serves me correctly, I think it was a tobacco check, yes.
Yeah, it was. So yeah, a lifetime devotion to cigarettes and the men who make and sell them, and women, I guess, who make and sell them. I don't know why I think of just tobacco companies as just being misogynist, just full of evil men running those things. But I'm sure there's some women who are running the tobacco companies as well, carrying out their terrible business. You know, a lifetime devotion to those folks. And it's paying off in a big way for Mr. Boehner. Congrats, my friend. You've earned it. You've earned it. Yeah. On the other side of the spectrum, people who are likely miserable about their job right now, the guy who replaced Boehner, Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Not only is Ryan having to field questions about Donald Trump every day, a task that Ryan has completely embarrassed himself in doing, by the way, having to constantly condemn Trump's remarks and at the same time continue to endorse him as president, showing really how pathetic Paul Ryan has been this year. Beyond that, though, Ryan has to deal with matters on Capitol Hill. Dysfunction on Capitol Hill, pretty much the same exact dysfunction that led to John Boehner retiring last year. Right now, Paul Ryan is staring down the fact that the government is running out of money at the end of the month, and that once again, Congress hasn't done its work passing appropriations bills, so it's more than likely that at some point between now and when the year ends, they're going to have to pass some giant trillion-dollar-plus omnibus bill that doesn't appropriately fund the government, but at least keeps everything functioning, and a bill that would almost certainly cause a revolt among his far-right members. as they do every time they're confronted with these sort of spending decisions. Now, what's likely to happen is Congress is going to pass a short-term funding bill in the next few weeks to get them through the elections, and then they'll get down to the dirty work of keeping the government funded for longer during the lame duck session in November and December. A lame duck session that is increasingly getting packed with unfinished business, I might add. Stay tuned for the TPP fight. Now, passing a huge omnibus at the end of the year is the same thing that Congress did last year. In fact, it was hammered out by John Boehner as a final FU to the Freedom Caucus on his way out the door. Well, the problem in this case for Paul Ryan is that he ain't on his way out the door. And him getting elected speaker next year hinges on him not telling far-right lawmakers in his party to F off, as John Boehner was able to do. As The Hill notes, Ryan knows he'll need backing from a handful of far-right Freedom Caucus members if he wants to remain speaker in the 115th Congress. He can get the nod from Republicans, but he will have to face a public roll call on the floor in January, and Ryan needs support for more than half the chamber, 218 votes, to win on the first ballot. Depending on how this election goes, he will likely, this election in November I'm talking about, he'll likely need to peel off some of those 40 or so Freedom Caucus folks to avoid that embarrassment in January. And there are already tensions between the two camps, by the way. Freedom Caucus members are furious that Ryan didn't do more to help save conservative Tim Husselkamp, who we mentioned earlier, who lost his primary this summer to a more responsible corporate Republican like Paul Ryan, who John Boehner was very happy about Husselkamp losing. According to sources reported by The Hill, Ryan has tried to charm his way out of problems with his far-right flank, meeting frequently with rank-and-file Republicans and building personal relationships with them. I wonder how that's going. Paul Ryan seems like the kind of guy that you hang out with once or twice, and you're like, yeah, he seems nice. He's harmless, cool guy. I'll hang out with him. And then you hang out with him a few more times, and you're like, God, this guy's lame as hell.
I bet they're just sitting there wishing they had built personal relationships with the guy who drank and smoked a lot.
Yeah.
Well, at least they could all just sit there drinking wine and looking at their phones.
Yeah. So good luck with that charm offensive over there, Paul. Now, Ryan is trying to get out of his bind by proposing that instead of passing one huge $1 trillion spending bill at the end of the year, he wants to break it up, pass smaller chunks, pass smaller spending bills that allow lawmakers to do a little more fine-tuning with funding levels. But Democrats, who can filibuster in the Senate, won't let that happen, it looks like. Senior Senate Democratic aide told The Hill that he was, quote, highly skeptical that Ryan's mini-bus strategy would bear fruit. He also said he didn't think the strategy would even appease the Freedom Caucus, which is willing to shut down the government. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said there's a small chance that Democrats could support the minibus strategy only if they were given assurances that the other parts of the budget wouldn't be shortchanged as well. Keep an eye on this. I can tell you someone who won't be keeping an eye on it, though, who likely doesn't give a damn about it all, Mr. John Boehner. Enjoy the cushy compensation over the tobacco company and the cigarettes for as long as you can, at least, John, for as long as you can. We now turn to some economic news for the 99%.
Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street!
Details of settlement negotiations between the Justice Department and Deutsche Bank spilled into the Wall Street Journal last week, causing the giant bank's share prices to tumble. The Journal reported that federal prosecutors proposed fining the bank $14 billion over misdeeds related to last decade's subprime mortgage meltdown. Friday morning, when markets opened, the bank's share prices plummeted sharply, falling 8%. The bank said that it sees $2 or $3 billion as a more appropriate penalty, according to the Journal, and that it only had about $6.2 billion in litigation reserves as of the end of the second quarter. Though negotiations over the deal are still ongoing, the news appears to have roiled markets in Europe. Bloomberg noted that shares in Credit Suisse, Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays, and UBS fell after the Deutsche Bank story broke. While U.S. rivals, including J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, have reached settlements, Bloomberg noted, with the Justice Department over the subprime meltdown, banks across the Atlantic have yet to resolve similar probes.
I like how Deutsche Bank is like, yeah, we really did some messed up stuff, but it's more around the order of $2 to $3 billion worth of messed up stuff rather than $14 billion. Jesus Christ, we're dealing in billions. That's
a lot. That's the way she goes, buddy. Turning back now briefly to the TPP, the deal could be doomed if it doesn't come up for a vote while President Obama is in office. And earlier this week, tech lobbyists and J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon argued for its imminent passage. Now President Obama has more soldiers in that war. On Friday, Ohio Governor John Kasich and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the good racist billionaire that liberals like. Remember, Bloomberg is a neoliberal authoritarian racist who presided over stop and frisk and warrantless surveillance of Muslims and defended those programs both very vociferously, but somehow Democrats think he's good and that Trump is also not. In a statement at the meeting on Friday before the press, President Obama said that the TPP was about the U.S. setting trade standards, and called TPP, quote, the most progressive and effective trade deal ever, which must be why Bloomberg and Kasich, a Republican, signed up for the lobbying effort.
Kasich just lost his Republican primary by running on trade deals. Why does President Obama think he's a good person to get this across? I have no clue.
I don't know, but I'm just staring at the paper, looking sad.
He is looking sad.
it's so baffling. I mean, it's so clueless. I don't know. But anyway, when the president said last year that the TPP was the most progressive trade deal ever, to hit out at criticism from Elizabeth Warren, her office responded with a thorough report that noted, quote, proponents of almost every free trade agreement in the last 20 years have made virtually identical claims.
That's true.
Warren, meanwhile, joined with a number of Democratic colleagues to ask Wells Fargo's CEO if the bank will punish executives who oversaw a massive fraud involving 2 million fake accounts opened in the name of its customers. Senators Sherrod Brown, Jack Reed, Bob Menendez, and Jeff Merkley, all members of the banking committee alongside Warren, joined in the letter, which was sent Friday. They asked Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf, what a great name, Stumpf. Anyway, they asked Stumpf if the board will invoke clawback clauses, try saying that three times fast, to recover compensation given to senior executives. This was not the work of a few rogue employees over the course of a few weeks, the senator said. The creation of unauthorized accounts stretched back as far as 2011, and Wells Fargo has fired over 5,000 employees, 2% of its total workforce, for engaging in this conduct. As CFPB Director Richard Cordray noted, Wells Fargo built an incentive compensation program that made it possible for its employees to pursue underhanded sales practices, and it appears that the bank did not monitor the program carefully.
And these clawback clauses are important because that way, you know, even when people crashed economy because of these or crashed a bank because of these perverse incentives, you can go and recoup that money back. So
I've got to say, I'm also not a fan of framing everything in the terms of somebody think of the shareholders.
Yeah,
but it is, I mean, that's stupid and annoying, but it is true that it's kind of unfair to punish shareholders for the actions of executives. And, you know, shareholders, by the way, oftentimes, you know, pension funds, municipalities investing. It's not just big Wall Street jerks either. The CFPB fined Wells Fargo $100 million earlier this month on top of $85 million in other fines from other regulators. The Justice Department announced last week that it, too, has opened its own investigations, and it hasn't taken criminal charges off the table yet.
Those charges will be coming off the table.
Yeah. It's almost guaranteed. In their letter, by the way, Senators Warren, Brown, Merkley, Reed, and Menendez singled out Carrie Tolstedt. She's Wells Fargo's Senior Executive Vice President of Community Banking, the division that oversaw the misconduct. The senators noted Tolstedt, quote, received more than $20 million in annual bonuses between 2010 and 2015, bonuses justified by the company in certain instances because of strong cross-sell ratios. Cross-selling, of course, is the practice that Wells Fargo was engaging in here when it created these fake accounts to boost sales numbers. Kolstad retired in July, by the way, 2 months before the CFPB settlement was revealed, with a retirement package worth up to $125 million U.S. American dollars.
Cha-ching, cha-ching. She cashed out at just the right time. See, fraud does pay.
It does
on
pay.
Wall Street.
Well, if you don't think so, you can call us at 202-684-6108. Again, this is our callback line. I'm kind of clumsily throwing it in there, but please give us a call on our callback line, 202-684-6108. We're running out of time.
Yeah, we'll play your rants on the air. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C., so you don't have to be.